Jacques was strongly in the category when I was an undergraduate of person to be avoided at all costs because he was the scariest guy.
Yeah.
Which is to say, he was the one for whom there was no bullshitting past your limitations.
Uh-huh.
As a reader and, you know, as a trained musician, it's like you could not pull the wool over his eyes about, like, with the kind of like, well, I can kind of read a score, because he'd whip out the score and lay it in front of you and say, okay, go ahead, buddy.
All right, well, since we're already here, then, who is Jacques-Louis Minot?
Jacques-Louis Minot is a Parisian. He was a child prodigy, admitted to the Paris Conservatoire at a very early age, with remarkable musical abilities. He studied there, I guess, for quite some time. So I think he started at like the age of 10 or something, and went on. He was a composer and conductor and pianist. He fought in the French Resistance in Paris. I believe he was awarded the Legion of Honor. I don't know if he accepted it. He subsequently conducted the BBC Orchestra, whatever, like their Tuesday night program, the new music programs.
Yeah.
He did that for some years. Eventually decided he wanted to move to New York, and the way to facilitate that was to, so he enrolled at Juilliard, where, my understanding is, he got to Juilliard and they gave him the placement tests and realized that he was better than anyone who was teaching there, and they asked him what he wanted to do, and what he wanted to do was to put on concerts of Viennese second school, Schoenberg, Berg, and Webern, and he did the first, I think, all Berg program in New York, and the first all Webern program in New York. And he became closely associated. I believe they wouldn't let him put on the all Schoenberg program.
Why?
I believe that they called him into the office, and it was a question of anti-Semitism.
No, really?
I believe so.
Now, why would Juilliard, coming off of the Second World War and all of that, have a problem with...
I'm not qualified to... I don't know.
And Jacques Jewish? Jacques was not
Jewish. No, Jacques was not Jewish, but he'd fought in the resistance, and his father and him, they were helping Jews escape from Nazis, sure, and risking their lives, you know. They're absolutely... His father was the surgeon to the Rothschilds, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, these are facts, and they should be checked.
How do you feel that? Here's a question. That's a long question. Jacques' musical training. What was the difference between that and the musical training you were getting at Columbia?
Well, not much. Except that I'm an immensely worse student than him. But essentially,
it was a question of studentship or ability?
Ability.
Yeah, ability.
Ability. I mean, he had started at the age of 10, he had perfect pitch, and, he had had the heaviest, the finest musical training you could get in Paris from the age of 10,
mm-hmm.
You know, and I didn't have perfect pitch, and I'm from Suffern, New York, and played Rolling Stones and stuff, you know, and had other things going on. And Jacques was very learned as far as musical history went as well. He also, his knowledge of repertoire was unbelievable.
Let's backtrack a bit. We got a little bit out of Jacques there.
Okay, so that's a background. Anyway, as an undergraduate, I avoided him because he was notorious for things like failing entire classes. They brought him, and he instituted, they've sort of made him, I believe, the theory and ear training czar.
Strumter. Yes, the Duke of your training.
Yeah, yeah. And, yeah. But so he, for instance, we did fixed do, you know, and we learned solfège the French way, and we were trained in intervals without tonality.
Explain the fixed do thing.
Fixed do, the note, the name of the note is do. It doesn't change to accommodate amateur singers.
That's always do, regardless of transposition.
So C is always do, regardless of the key.
Right.
And C sharp is do as well.
Mm.
Yeah, it is a standard thing. Yeah, there's no, you don't go do, D, re, re. No, it's do, C.
C and C sharp.
Well, the sharp is an inflection.
Okay, so it's do. So that's considered an altered do.
Yes.
An alteration of do.
Yes.
Okay, very good. And so
this facilitates. Also, we were trained very much.
What's the good
forced
of this?
Forced to learn all of the clefs.
What's the good of this besides the fact that it's difficult?
Well, if you learn fixed do and you learn all the clefs, then you can use the clefs for transposing for score reading, which greatly facilitates score reading then, because instead of reading the trumpet part, the trumpet's in B flat, and instead of reading it in and having to do the transposition for each one, you simply read it as if it were in C, with fixed do, using the tenor clef.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and this is the older system for score readings, and et cetera. So that was the goal.
So let's go a little bit older than that. Now let's get back to undergraduate, get away from
okay.
The Giants here. Let's see whether, now you said you had a big snare that went on with music from the Middle Ages. What was striking to you about music from the Middle Ages, or what sat with you from standing or from looking at that?
Well, at first, it was music from the Middle Ages was kind of bizarre because, first of all, there was a lot of dealing with, like, the mannerist stuff, and so you're talking about enormously complicated schemes, like isorhythmic motets and things like that, and I think there was also, and that, led to this notion of a music in which intellect is highly valued. So
you said something in the previous interview, where we got down to a point where you said that your interest in complexity, because I was asking you why you were attracted to more
right.
complicated music, and you said that it equated with consciousness expansion.
Yes.
So the question is, in the Middle Ages, do you think those musicians, those composers, were seeing things in terms of consciousness expansion?
Now, you see, that would violate a basic tenet of the Paul Henri Lang School of Musicology, because it would involve making a sweeping generalization.
Yeah, okay.
And we were taught to not make sweeping generalizations, but of course, when you're a composer, you kind of have to.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd be reluctant to answer the question for fear that Taruskin might come across this interview and correct me for making an ignorant, sweeping generalization. At the time...
I'll send him a link to the idea.
At the time, my reaction to the medieval music was... It was cool because the counterpoint involved fourths.
Mm-hmm.
And being a rock and roll guitar player,
that would be like
that's a great sound, right?
It's in fourths, right? So the reason I asked it the way that I did is that okay, like you're looking clearly what your something in your mind is directing you towards these complexities, these things that have schemes and complexities. Now, for sure, we're in the Middle Ages and the Renaissance and all this. This has to do with... I mean, the reason I ask that is because a lot of wonderful things about the Renaissance actually do have to do with a fair amount of human consciousness expansion, although we're going
to... I should preface this by saying At the time, I was doing what they told me to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I probably had some more grandiose delusions going on, but I'm not so sure that I actually had them at that time. I was just desperately trying to put all this information into my brain with the idea that I'd process it later.
Okay.
You know, so a lot of it was just desperately trying to keep up with these readings and these classes.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
That was a lot of reading.
Yes.
And had you already elected it to be... was this already in the direction of composition, or were you still a player?
I was completely intending to be a composer.
Okay, this was
from
this
day
was in
one.
Your head.
Which also confused... That confused the people at Columbia. I actually got into trouble at one point because I took too many points in music. Too much of my program was music.
Mm.
And this led to... I got called in by the dean.
Mm-hmm.
Who called me in to chastise me for taking too many classes in music and to get me to take other classes, which led to a kind of amusing confrontation, because you have to also remember, my father was a philosopher and a historian of medieval scholasticism, and he had taught me to disdain comparative literature. Which I still really do disdain. I just think it's the funniest thing to sit around and talk about fiction for hours and hours. It's kind of like being a Trekkie.
Mm-hmm.
That is, it's a way of pandering to your escapist fantasies.
Well, you live in
the realm of the escapist fantasy, so it's not just enough to read the damn Joyce. You have to sit around and talk about it forever.
Yeah.
And without, it's like, but it's fiction.
Mm-hmm.
It says on the label of the book that it is lies. So this basically led to me going into the dean and telling him, I am not, because I knew my friends, who were all Columbian guys, and I knew what they would want me to do, and they would want me to take some comparative literature, thinking that this would, enlighten me, and I thought of it as a totally demeaned field. And so the confrontation led to me going into the dean and basically telling him, I am not taking these lame-ass comp lit courses. I'm not going to take any of them.
Mm-hmm.
I'm simply not. No, it's not happening.
Mm-hmm.
And we compromised, and I took one class in cognitive psychology to round out my education.
Mm-hmm. So is... I'm going to say something now that's a bit of a rebuttal, a friendly rebuttal here, but a debating thing. Now, there's two things really that I want to cover in what you're talking about. One thing relates to something that you said before, one thing doesn't. But when you make this criticism of comparative literature, whether your father did, and you say it's fiction, and that you're sitting there talking about the fiction afterwards, couldn't the same thing be leveled at musical pieces?
No.
And is that just a prejudice or a bias, or is that... why is it different?
Because musical pieces are true.
In what sense?
They exist as musical pieces. They're like a piece of sculpture. Now the story behind the sculpture might not be true, but the sculpture itself actually is true, whereas all there is in the book is the story, which is patently false. And the other thing is that the fiction, for me, I think it's very dangerous that human beings, like one of the most dangerous things in the universe, that human beings do not easily distinguish between fiction, in which all the points on the moral compass are controlled by the imagination of an individual who's creating this world, and reality, in which the points on the moral compass are completely different than they are in the fiction, and people come to believe these moral compasses that are created out of fantasy, and they kill each other over them.
Mm-hmm. And so... All of the pieces that you hear that are from the Middle Ages that are Renaissance composers that are...
One day... Okay, so this we'll switch back over to Pat Carpenter here, because I remember Pat Carpenter asking me, after we had started to really develop a relationship as me as her disciple, and she asked me if I thought that pieces of music, whether they could be true or not. And that was like one of those, she would ask me these things every now and then, and then it would turn into like a years-long project in my mind trying to work out what she meant, what the question was about, how could this question even be? Can a piece of music be true? Can a piece of music be false? You know, we're not talking about the literary associations with the piece of music, but just the notes themselves, can they be either true or false? So I guess ultimately, in a certain sense, I would say they don't fall into the same category of truth value. That is to say, to apply the notion of truth or falsity to a sounding collection of pitches is to misapply the category of true and false to an object that doesn't really take that quality.
May I go a little bit further with this, just as an example, because I think...
But then there's another question, which is, can't composers lie?
Which, well, they definitely can. Plenty of lie, kill, and all the rest of it, but in the time of Homer, whether or not it was one guy or not, the Iliad or the Odyssey was a recitation. The book itself, the thing you're talking about, is may be a lie.
That's another.
But if a fellow gets up and reads it and performs it, now what is it?
Yeah, there you go. There's another range of question that's raised, which is, well, what is history?
I was about to get there because we're in
I know all these problems exist. In any case, I wasn't going to take Carl Selig's Don Quixote. It wasn't happening.
Okay, I understand. I wasn't trying to question whether they exist. I'm really just trying to get the information out for you. I'm going for the imaginary listener here.
Right. And I am a total sucker for Harry Potter and the Lord of the Rings, and you know, I have my escapist fantasy. Things that I use history a lot as escapist fantasy to go and read. Nothing better than reading about the delicious slaughter of some innocents to you know, help you get to sleep at night.
Well, I know we've talked about film theory and early theoreticians in this, and you know, you were impacted by them, and they sit around discussing whether or not the film as an artifact is anything. What level of thing it is, whether it's real or whether it's depiction or not.
And of course, being involved now with the Treme has really boggled the mind. It's essentially depicting, you know, in some way, a portion of my life, and then you're watching it be depicted, so you're going over to Davis Rogan's fake apartment for a scene, and you've been to the real apartment, and here's the depiction. You know, and you're being asked to depict yourself. There, that's a good one. I want you to act like yourself. No. It's a little bit, no, more like this. Could you do that a little more casually? You know, it's like, but I'm supposed to be myself. Can I? Anyway.
Easier for you than Kermit. No. So we're in the undergraduate. Okay, so now you brought Pat Carpenter. Did you encounter her when you were an undergraduate?
Here's what happened. I had Pat Carpenter for Forman Analysis. And we hit that class, and there were four of us, I think, in that class who were very bright and paying attention and very, and really working hard. And you know, it was a year-long class, and it was a tremendous, amazing class. We had all had Counterpoint in the Style of Bach and Chromatic Harmony with Taruskin, which was also extraordinary, very excellent.
Chromatic Harmony was.
both. I mean, we'd had Fugue, essentially, and then we had Chromatic Harmony with Taruskin the year before. And so we were coming in fairly well equipped. You know, we'd been through this Munoz ear training score reading stuff. In any case, that class was really special, and it was an amazing year. And it was like the light coming through the clouds. It really managed to make things make sense.
What was that? Like, now, why? What is it? That, what was it? What's really the juice in there in Chromatic Harmony?
Never mind the Chromatic Harmony. Let's go to the Forman analysis.
Oh yeah, let's go with that.
The Forman analysis was, I mean, it was getting a glimpse at how these people composed this music. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, in a real, very real way, or at least what the pieces were. I mean, it was like by the time she got done with the piece. You had a they became, she had a way of laying out the organic unity of the piece that was phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
It was just absolutely phenomenal. And if you really carefully, if you could follow her, which was not easy, you know, because it involved being able to hold a whole bunch of music in your head.
Mm-hmm.
But if you could actually follow it, then you actually got a sense of how the composer came to think the piece.
Right.
And, you know, she would take it down to the Grundgestalt, the basic shape, the basic motive, and she could take the car apart, the automobile apart, and put it back together.
What is Grundgestalt?
A Grundgestalt is the basic shape. It is that shape from which the other shapes are derived in a piece of music. According to, there's a term used by Schoenberg.
Mm-hmm.
It's the fundamental motive. It's usually some little contrapuntal relationship that then to which you can trace all the events of the piece.
And where was Pat Carpenter coming from? What's her story?
Pat Carpenter had been she had been a student of Schoenberg. I believe she had studied with him for 6 years. She had also, I think, been his personal secretary.
In Los Angeles?
In Los Angeles. She had come to, she had been a, she was a conductor and a pianist as well.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that she was the first person to actually read the piano concerto with an orchestra.
Did she tell you? Sorry.
And then she had a stroke at some point in her life, and I don't know whether that's what curtailed her conducting career. But she went to Columbia, and she was also had worked in the philosophy department with Hofstadter and these guys, and so she was also a very good friend of my father's.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so,
now, did she tell you at all what studying with Schoenberg was about?
Well, I think essentially we did what it was.
You did what it was.
I believe that we were essentially doing most of the activities that we were engaging in that form of analysis class were, at least in her mind, simply straight up the way that he taught.
The way that he taught. And, there's something interesting here, which is that there's a it looks like some kind of mad, alignment of the stars or something that sets this particular set of faculty in this school at the same time for you. I'm trying to get around to this Schoenberg thing. Why is this? Because it keeps coming up here, and I want to get around to what is. What a bunch of musicians that are this relevant or that are this cognizant of music from the 11th century to the 20th century. What's the importance here with this Schoenberg character that keeps rolling?
Well, I think one of the things that Pat did, one of the articles that she was very famous for, was an analysis of a motet by Dufay, because she, like the rest of the guys, she'd been put through the Paul Henri Lang mill and had been, you know, made to learn all this. So I've actually, in addition, this actually happened later, but we studied medieval theory intensely, but that was kind of that was later on in graduate school. No, I guess we did some of it at that point in time. But she was looking back at the earlier stuff and looking at it for the coherence and trying to get at this the organic unity of these older things.
She was trying to go back to the what was the unity of the older things.
I don't think she tried. I think she did.
Yeah, okay, that's what I meant. But I mean, I'm saying that was what she was looking at that point. It was an archival.
That was amongst the things that she was doing. So, she was very much concerned with this with Schomburg's. She ultimately put a lot of work into coming out with this book, The Musical Idea, which is Schomburg's attempt to elucidate this kind of notion of organic unity of the piece as having this coherence, because it has this fundamental idea that is the impetus for the composing of the piece, and that you can find running throughout the piece. And she was not only interested in that, she was interested in this from a philosophical point as well. So, for instance, she was writing articles like Schomburg, Hanslick, Kant, like talking about Kant's influence on this music critic and theorist Hanslick and the relationship of Schomburg to them. So she was very much, she was a history of ideas person.
So, and Schomburg was—he's the same sort of person.
Yes, I believe so. From everything I've read, yes, absolutely.
And
I don't think he didn't quite have as much access to music history because it was a still somewhat fledgling field. Uh-huh. You know,
that's interesting.
But he had some access to it because of Webern's, because Webern was a musicologist. But you know, it wasn't really. And musicology seriously grew in the 20th century. You know, there isn't as much musical history stuff. They're not terrific accounts of what happened. And it wasn't thought of, I think, as a mainstream academic field until the 20th century. Mm-hmm. As far as I can tell. I mean, we would go, and then we had to read all these histories of music from the past. So I don't think Schomburg had quite the range of access to materials and things that Pat had, but I think he was a philosopher, you know.
And did you feel that this was an innovation on his part relative to the composers, the background of the world that he came out of? I mean, my understanding from looking at these same...
Well, as far as I can tell, everybody who lived in Vienna from between 1900 and 1920 was a freaking philosopher.
Mm.
Many of them highly deluded.
Mm-hmm.
And they're famous. I mean, all those Viennese schools of philosophy that come out of that, they're famous for, I mean, really just going for the throat. So this guy like Weininger thinks that human beings should cease to exist because sex is a demeaning to the spirit, and so we should stop procreating, and that's perfectly fine. Or
it's very green.
You know, the Austrian school of economics, which we're looking at the consequences of now, where they essentially have an anarchist perspective that, you know, if 500 people die for the benefit of 50,000, then that's a good trade-off. You know,
so,
that's fine. I hope none of their children come looking for you. Mm-hmm. You know, there were all kinds of, you know, it was a very heated environment. A very high-end intellectual environment. which I think was probably a tradition that had kind of kicked into the music stuff with the advent of Beethoven, really. Mm-hmm. That is to say, Mozart was still Bach and Mozart. They were musicians. They didn't talk about what they did that much. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't until and then Beethoven comes on, and then people get the idea that, oh, there's something really grandly intellectual going on here that we can kind of grasp. With Bach, there was that sort of thing, but it's like, oh, it's really these funny little puzzles that he puts together or something.
But this has to be, excuse me for interjecting, but this has to be anachronistic imposition, because we know all those people from the Florentine Camerata thought of it the way NASA thinks about the... I mean, their position on music was that it was the same thing as, you know,
yeah,
as a particle accelerator. They didn't really... They used to run things in those terms, so what...
It's like if you... I'm thinking of the world in which Bach lived the reaction of a lot of people being like, well, you know, I don't know why you write all this hard stuff, dude. It's like too hard. Uh-huh. You know, we don't really like it because it's too naughty and K-N-O-T-T-Y. And Mozart certainly is brilliant. But it's and there's some stuff that is somewhat, but the idea that music is really like almost a some kind of metaphysics, it was something that I think that they had, yes indeed, at the Florentine time, and it was but at the time of from a lot of people, and it's always and it's still this way, it's like, why, how can you possibly mistake this pastime, which is appropriate for drinking and chasing women, or maybe, you know, like being holy and worshiping God, for something that has its own significance?
Well, it's interesting because it's not like people were suggesting that drinking and chasing women didn't have power.
It's always, yeah.
That's a tremendous power, and there's no doubt that's a driving force. You know, it's still our problem, like we were talking about with Shell and Mick Jagger.
Yeah, that is to say, I don't know how much familiarity Beethoven had with the scores of Achingham.
Right.
I mean, that wasn't, or even Schoenberg, you know. But by the time I was going to Columbia, they were certainly going to make sure that we dealt with some Achingham.
Yeah, I mean, they make a big point in the documentary, the bizarre documentary that Werner Herzog made about what's his name, about the other medieval, the crazy one. Anyway, they make the point that the Stravinsky showed up there to write pieces about those fellows. So that must have been late in Stravinsky's career, when he was already, you know, thinking that everyone, he had to prove to everybody that, you know,
he knew something about music history.
That he knew old music or something, you know.
Yeah.
Really an overly grandiose, puffed-up scenario, but
now we're talking about musical history things, and better you go to California and talk to Ruskin, or better yet, talk to my wife, she's here, because it's another.
I'm just trying to get
one of those things. My father is the philosopher. I'm the philosopher's son. My wife is the music historian. I just shoot my mouth off and make sweeping generalizations. But I would point out that one of the things was the rise in the late 18th century, beginning of the 19th century, of St. Cecilia societies. And these societies where people would get together to sing Palestrina.
Okay.
And suddenly there's this like rebirth of an interest in older music.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I think that for many generations before that, older music was something you just discarded.
Well, I mean, I'm thinking about that now. I've been writing pieces, actually, that I'm about to post, actually, which are about this. And I did one in connection with a review of somebody's record locally. Because this is an interesting feature to me, how much like now we've gone through a period where everyone is so interested in folk music, whether or not it's authentic. I've been the victim of it. I'm sure you have.
Ah, the aficionados.
The aficionados. And it took precedence. And you can see how it comes in because, of course, you know, like even we were talking about the Stones. Like everyone's got to talk about, well, we were really into the blues. And so, you know, and then there's the real blues and the fake blues. And everybody's running around doing this act, right, which comes from a bunch of 19th century imperialist Victorian bullshit that has to do with the savage, which you actually can't believe that people want to resuscitate that after, like, people like Picasso knifed it in the throat so hard at the top of the 20th century. You know, at least in terms of the artifact, it's kind of bizarre. But that, you know, and then I'm glad to hear that you said the Palestrina societies, they got an obsession with stuff that's old.
Yes, yeah, but their idea of what was old was essentially Palestrina.
Yeah, which is funny.
But right. They didn't really, I don't think they actually delved into, like, Josquin or Lassus. You know, they didn't know about those, just the Palestrina, you know, because that was. And then we developed this myth that
Counter Reformation music.
Yeah, or there's a whole species counterpoint mythology that Fuchs invented species counterpoint based on the style of Palestrina, and it's just this one little odd artifact, and it doesn't have. Without anybody knowing that, like, actually, essentially, species counterpoint had been going on for centuries already, and he was just writing down what was common knowledge.